This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
You're listening to Surreal Talk, a look inside the world of cults, conspiracies, and the paranormal.
Something's not right, man. Something's not right. Something's bullshit here, and I don't believe it.
Honestly, this crazy shit could be completely possible.
Disclaimer, we reserve the right to be wrong, ladies and gentlemen. You think you know the whole story? Think again.
Now your hosts, Eric and Everett.
Welcome to Surreal Talk, a look inside the world of cults, conspiracies, and the paranormal, a lineupmedia.fm production, and we are back.
Welcome back.
How you guys feeling this week? We have a special guest with us. Fred, will you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, that was a really professional intro. That was pretty cool.
It almost gives the wrong idea.
Yeah, I am the best at the intro. Like, the middle of the show, I'm not so good at, like, all the facts and shit like that, but the intro, gosh, I kill it every time.
The intro's awesome, and then the rest of it's just like somebody's bathroom when you're drunk.
It's lackluster for sure.
It's like being born rich in life. It's pretty much yours to screw up from there on. So this week we're talking about Charles Manson and the family and everything surrounding that, but I want to go back to last week real quick. We got some emails and some comments about me being a little harsh on Eric on our Pizzagate episode, and I wanted to read some of the quote-unquote fan mail. So we'll start with a comment on our website.
Fan mail. I don't think that's the word I'd choose to describe it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, fan mail. A guy going by the handle of Guy Fox, anonymous. You get that at all?
Yeah, I get it.
Anyway, he says, I am usually a very easy critic as long as I hear something interesting and somewhat based in a feasible reality. But this podcast was nearly unlistenable. I was attempting to get some information out of what one fellow had to say, but the mouth-breathing know-it-all was so emotionally bankrupt and uncomfortable with the subject. It begs the question, could he be the victim of such child abuse? Stop you right there. No, I was not, as far as I can remember. I appreciate a heavy dose of skepticism and source-checking, as any true investigator should. But the one guy's just over the top, not going to let you say anything in your face. Was I like that?
Yes.
I wouldn't let you say anything.
Nothing.
It was a boring hour then, I guess.
Huh? It sure was.
I didn't think so. He's the guy at the beach who would stomp out someone else's sandcastle. That's just personal.
Yeah, I like that.
I've never stomped even my own castle. I like just to let them get washed.
You got mad that time I pissed in the toy box.
Yeah. We've been over that. It was a bad idea.
Right.
I can't believe you brought that up. He's the guy who always has a one-up story to counter yours. Again, totally false. I'm not a one-upper. The fact that he responds with such strong emotional vigor while completely ignoring any possibility of a connection is just mind-boggling and questionable itself. Hoping he personally reads this.
I would have
mission
to
accomplished
venture,
there.
I would have to venture to say that guy's more Team Eric than Team Everett.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess he had to be a first-time listener. I usually give everything a chance. Pizzagate, I gave a chance. I just did maybe not on the show.
No.
But for the week before, I had been neck deep in Pizzagate research, and it was like walking through crap. You know, it's just getting all over me, and I didn't want it on me anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
You felt dirty.
I felt dirty.
Oh.
Like it was just a load of crap, and we were wasting our time.
Now, do I get to call you mouth breather from now on?
He has a point. I am a mouth breather. Last week, I had a real good cold, too, so my nose was real congested. So that could be right where he's coming from. But traditionally, I do. I'm a mouth breather. But yeah, call me what you want. We had another comment on Twitter. It says, it's awful when you do these and dude just denies the whole time. Hard to listen to. He's not wrong. I did listen back to it. It was kind of hard to listen to.
Yeah, it was. It was rough. I watched the YouTube video.
So I'll try not to be such a dick from now on and give Eric at least a chance to paint the picture, no matter how.
I kind of like how Everett reads all of our bad fan mail or our bad mail. We don't read you guys the good ones because those are for us. But no, we just read the bad ones on Eric.
I don't want to sound conceited, but it would take too much time.
Ooh, listen to you.
All right, you ready for the meat?
Yeah, we got to introduce our guest. We were in the middle of doing that when you just interrupted.
Sorry. Anyway, Fred, welcome to the show. Fred and I worked with each other for a few years at a local newspaper. Hit it, man. Who are you?
My name is Fred Pollard. I work for a different newspaper in the area as an editor. Do you want me to
you can say whatever you want?
Why I'm
books?
Anything you want to say? Open forum, Pollard.
They wanted to bring me in because I have been for the last few years, been working on a book about the members of Charles Manson's cult, The Family. So yep. I guess that's why I'm a celebrity today.
That is why you are our local celebrity on this subject. whenever I started thinking that this was a good subject, you popped around in my head. I was like, man,
that's
finally, I know somebody who can actually talk about something with a little bit of, you know, more than I just saw some YouTube videos.
Oh, so you're looking directly at me when you say that. God damn it.
All the people that, you know, that you think of when you think of, you know, helping out homeless animals or, you know, feeding the hungry or anything. You think about serial killers and, oh, my God, it's Fred.
Yeah, Fred. If it's serial killer, I'm getting a hold of Fred. He said he was listening to our serial killer show, and we were, you know, how we were a little lax on some of the facts. We were like, oh, I don't know this. Apparently, he was listing off everything we didn't know as we were doing.
As we were listening, hell yeah.
That's funny. All right, Charles Manson, whatever you want to call him. Do you know what he prefers to be called, anybody? Charlie?
Crazy.
He doesn't like Chuck.
Doesn't like Chuck. Good to know. I'm just going to call him Charles.
Charlie.
I think he likes Charlie the best, but.
So anyway, what do we know about him, Everett?
Well, he was born, let me get to my time.
Next to nothing.
We know a lot about Charlie Manson. He was born in 1934 in Cincinnati. He was the illegitimate son of a prostitute named Kathleen Maddox, and his father, who apparently Manson had never met. You could probably, some of this might be wrong. Fred's a lot more study on this. But it's claimed it was a man named Colonel Scott from Ashland, Kentucky. You know, is that, I mean, you were telling me he might have actually had an African-American father.
Yeah, that's the rumor. That's a possibility. Nobody's, I don't think, ever really going to know for sure because she was kind of a whore.
good point.
Wait.
What do you got?
I could be wrong, but he's white, right? I mean.
He looked it, but just because you have a black parent doesn't mean that those genes express.
Well, I mean, yeah, I've seen, like, you know, happen once or twice, but I mean, is that really can happen?
Yeah, it can.
That's happen. Something that can happen.
Sure,
yeah,
it is.
Can happen. Holy
anything,
shit.
Anything's possible in this crazy world. It reminds me of the whole Hitler thing where he might have been part Jewish, and that's why, you know, like, he hated that he was Jewish, and that's why he went after. And you were saying that Charles Manson's finding out that he might have been part black could have enhanced his paranoia, you know, and his thought that there was a civil war between blacks and whites, a race war coming up.
Right. It could have easily have played into it if he took it seriously.
Yeah, that's the thing with him. I still don't know if he was really serious about all the stuff he was spouting all the time.
I think some of his followers took it a little more seriously than he did.
I think so too.
The guy's name that you just said, his dad, like on paper.
Sure.
What was his name?
Scott, Colonel Scott.
Colonel Scott, yeah. He was actually murdered in Kentucky, and they think that might have been a family murder as well, because it was, I think it was like 68.
Wow.
Somebody actually murdered his illegitimate father. Somebody did.
Possibly. Yeah. At least that man was murdered if that was his father. So in 1939, 5 years after his birth, his mother sentenced to prison. She was a heavy drinker. She did an armed robbery, I guess, for a little bit of cash.
We won't hold that against her, though.
What, doing an armed robbery?
No, being a heavy drinker.
I mean, that's no real excuse for that either. 47, his mother tries to send him to a foster home. The court orders him sent to a school for boys in Terre Haute, Indiana, like 3 or 4 hours from here. So got kind of a local route to us.
Yeah, I didn't know that. There's more than one local route, because that gal that was interested in him that was, you know, they were married. She's from Bethalto, she's 10 minutes away from her hometown.
She's from Bethalto?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, right? Mm-hmm. A guy that I went to high school, or that I go work with, went to high school with that guy.
Yeah, I saw videos of her and him together, and she apparently gave him a haircut or something in one of the videos. Real bizarre.
Real bizarre.
She was from Bethalto.
She was from Bethalto. A guy
that's
I worked with went
town.
To school with her.
So that's pretty weird.
Yeah, that's, I don't know.
But that was broke off because she apparently wanted to sell his remains after he died for a profit, and Charlie wasn't into the Charles.
Oh, it wasn't true love?
I can't say that.
Huh.
Maybe she did love him.
That's crazy. Sell his remains, huh? Just put him on display and, like, come see Charlie. What was she going to do, try to preserve him? I don't understand.
Petri dishes of Charlie. Ashes? I don't know.
Wow. Okay.
If I had somebody, like, 60 years younger than me that was wanting to marry me so that they could build, like, a shrine to me after I died and profit off of it, I'd be like,
fine.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Where's the problem?
Fine, come visit me. I haven't had a woman in forever. If I can get a conjugal out of this.
But, you know, something tells me it wasn't hard for him to, like, get a woman. Because I read something that said he receives more mail than any other inmate in history. Up to the tune of 60,000 pieces a year.
You shitting me.
Of mail.
Yep. And
than any other inmate in history.
Yep. And it's young people. It's not people from his generation. It's young people that, you know.
I'm worried about this country.
Send them letters and say right on.
Fell right on, man. Let's convince people to murder people.
Yeah. Because we got to be clear. Like, he didn't actually murder anyone, right?
No murder.
Not that we know of?
That we know of. He did shoot a man, but the man lived. We'll get to that part of the story here in a little bit. But he, as far as we know, has never murdered anyone.
He does a good job of keeping his hands clean, or he did, thinking that he'd be able to slip underneath the radar that way. But
so if I understand it right, he was just a master manipulator. He was very good with words. He just was
just like any other cult leader,
able to just totally fricassee these people's brains into believing whatever he wanted.
Yeah, that's what's so funny about, you know, people that see him in interviews and stuff, and he just rambles, and it you know, appears to be gibberish. He's actually incredibly intelligent. He's very bright.
That's what I was telling you.
And in fact, he would do this rambling gibberish thing in court during the trials, and it wouldn't make sense to anybody, but his followers would be able to pick out key phrases out of his ranting.
And pick up little commands or whatever.
Yeah, he was telling them how to do things, how to fire their attorney, what he wanted them to get up and do in the middle of the court when they were, you know, getting up and interrupting the proceedings and everything. They could decipher that because he was smart enough to work it into his rambling.
Figure out a code of some sort. Yeah, it's like whenever POWs would blink with their eyes.
Exactly. So these people that see him and, oh, he's just crazy. He's nuts. He doesn't make any sense. He's gone. And no, he's still.
I imagine he probably had a pretty high IQ. I mean,
I don't think his IQ was that high, really.
Oh, really?
But he just learned how to work people during his years in prison.
Must have been pretty good at it, though. To convince people to kill people for you or for your cause, you got to be a master manipulator.
Yep.
I'd like to know the mindset, because from the interviews I've seen with the women, they didn't know they were going those nights to kill anyone beforehand. Did they text?
Oh, they didn't have any beforehand.
They knew. They knew something was going to happen. They didn't know the details.
Sure, sure.
But they knew what they were going for. In fact, Leslie said that she was kind of upset that she didn't get to go the first night. She knew what was going to happen. And she said everything in her body language said, I want to go. Which is one of the reasons that she thinks she was picked for the second night.
Man, she's the one I thought, after reading all of her, or watching all of her interviews, that seemed to be the most sorry about it. But
I think she is. But at the time, she wanted to prove herself
so much of that Kool-Aid,
as a good soldier. Yeah, yeah. And she says it didn't seem real to her until they got in the house and it started happening, and then she was like, "Oh,
the shock hit you.
This is real." And that's when she was like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Never mind. Check, please.
Everybody's into that cult until it's time to do some cult shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all, I'm cool. I'm in the cult. That's fine. And then they want you to go kill somebody.
And like, oh, man, maybe I don't want to be in this cult.
Pussies.
Yep, exactly. You're going to do something, do it right.
Right. Commit. So in 1948, Manson commits his first known crime, the burglary of a grocery store. He is caught and sent to a juvenile detention center. So this is his first incarceration.
How old at the time?
1948, that would have made him 15, 14? Yeah, 14.
I was going to say 14, I think, when that happened.
He's caught, sent to detention. He escapes and commits two more armed robberies. He's apprehended and sent to the Indiana School for Boys in Plainsfield, where he spends the next 3 years, except for a few brief stints of freedom during when he was 18. He escapes.
Did all that on the lam?
No, this is written horribly. So he escaped a few times up until the point where he was 18. And I guess he was released when he was 18.
Huh. So it's been like an ever-progressing, he started out with armed robbery, and it's just he progressed as he got older and crazier?
Nah, it doesn't look like he does much more than stealing, honestly.
I mean, okay, so let me ask you a question. Has he ever had any, like, real psychiatric evaluations is the dude legitimately crazy, or I don't understand, like, how is that?
He's not crazy.
He's not crazy. Okay, so I didn't know this.
I think that they have determined that he is a sociopath.
Okay.
Which, you know, usually a lot of people don't understand that term, but it actually sounds a little worse than it is. A sociopath is somebody that just doesn't have empathy.
Yep.
Okay,
they're not able to feel regret or sympathy for family members who have lost people, you know, things like that.
Right.
So I think that he has been determined to be a sociopath. Paranoia, rejection reaction, I think. He was diagnosed with that as well. He hasn't never been diagnosed as being, you know, psychotic, suffering from psychosis. No, he's
it's calculated, I would say. honestly, in everything he does, I'd say he's calculated.
Yeah, he is. He very much plays for the camera, so he knows what he's doing.
Did you see the Diane Sawyer interviews at all?
I did not.
That's one of the real big things you'll find out there when you're looking.
Is that the one where they ask him who he is and he does that?
That might be the one.
I am nobody.
Now that you say that, though, where he did, it's pretty famous, that little clip where he makes all those weird contortions of his face saying that's who he is. You think that could have been a signal similar to what he did in prison?
No, I think if I remember right, I think that's when Geraldo was interviewing him, and he knew that Geraldo was such a buffoon that Manson just had fun with Geraldo the whole time. He was like, you know, I'm not going to take this interview seriously because this guy is a dumbass.
That's what makes me think the guy's almost at genius level, because he can just like read people so easily.
Yeah, the Geraldo interview was just him clowning. It wasn't even Manson. I think the Diane Sawyer interview was closer to the real Manson, what you saw there, because you saw some anger and you saw some resentment over, you know, how he thinks he's been wronged and things along those lines. And you get to see that venom come out. And I think that's closer to the real Manson than the, you know, the goofy guy that people look at or think of that, you know, says stuff that makes no sense or makes the faces that, you know, that he does just to get attention.
I like when he talked about whenever if somebody didn't follow his order to the T, like it was again from that interview where he finally showed some of his actual rage, and I can't do a verbatim what he said, but something along the lines, if you don't get it done, then I'm going to have to step in and get it done, and you don't want that. And that was one of the few times I thought he was being just seriously cracked out of his shell, and it's just, that's when he shows it what he really is.
So we think he was capable of murder, he just never had to do it.
Well, here's what I would say. He's full of shit for the most part, but don't stand close to him.
That's probably a good way to, way to put it.
Okay.
Because he's just, you know, full of shit enough to believe himself, in my opinion.
Which, well, actually, now, I mean, you could stand next to him because you just kind of push him down.
Fair enough.
I mean,
he's still old, frail, and fragile isn't he?
But, when he was in his 30s, I wouldn't want to give him a place to stay for the night and go to sleep.
No. Nope. Okay, let's see here. 1951, Manson escapes from a school of boys and heads west in a stolen car, burglarizing 15 to 20 gas stations along the way. It's pretty prolific. He's caught in Utah and sent to the National Training School for Boys in Washington, D.C., where a psychiatrist calls Manson a slick but extremely sensitive boy.
Huh.
And that would make sense when you get pissed off whenever he eventually thinks that they're stealing his music. The Beast Boys stole some of his music and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was friends with the drummer, right? Him and the drummer.
Yeah, Dennis Wilson was actually more or less a member of the family for a while. They lived with him.
If I'm going to understand it correctly, what had happened, a couple of the female members of the family were going down the highway, walking down the highway, and Dennis Wilson pulled over and picked them up as hitchhikers for whatever reason.
Yep.
They had hung out with him for a day or so before basically the rest of the family moves
into
his
house. Well, it was that day. He was driving along the Pacific Coast Highway, picked him up, took him back, of course had sex with him because he had sex with anything that moved.
Why would you?
And and then that was it. And then he thought he was done with his daily conquest and
see you ladies.
Went to the studio, came back that night, and the family had basically moved into his house, and Charlie Manson came out of the house and bent down and kissed his feet and said, "Welcome home," and that was it.
This isn't so bad.
So he lived with the drummer from Beach Boys. I did not know that. Yeah. They lived with the drummer
The
from
family,
the Beach Boys.
The family lived at his house. And they invaded Brian Wilson's house during rehearsals and stuff because they had the studio in Brian Wilson's house. Uh-huh. And, Wendy and Carney Wilson, Brian's wife at the time had to, like, keep them away because they all creeped her out. They were real dirty.
I can imagine.
Yeah, they would leave, and Brian's wife would, like, clean the whole house and Clorox the bathroom and everything because she said they were just gross.
Gross, yeah. Whew.
So were any of his followers drugged up consistently? Because one of our listeners, Keith Daly, he might say they were drugged up like crazy all the time. So were they on drugs? Was that something that was?
They were taking a lot of psychedelic drugs. I think the drugs sometimes are used as an excuse. I think that they used a lot of LSD, and he would take advantage of the fact that, you know, when they were on a trip and their minds were open
really
and expanded,
impressionable at
that
point.
That's when you're the most impressionable, and he would use that. That's when he would preach his sermons. So he definitely used drugs as a tool.
That's CIA level shit there.
Yeah, it is.
And when you and some of the wilder family members would mix other drugs. Susan Atkins and Tex Watson, they, you know, messed around with belladonna, which is like heavy duty stuff.
I never even heard of that.
Yeah, me either.
And it's it's a route that it just whacks your mind out big time. And so they were doing that on top of the LSD trips that they were taking, smoking pot all the time. Sure. So I think it was a combination. Some of them were pretty whacked out on drugs. Others weren't. I mean, they were pretty coherent. But it was definitely a part of the daily routine for the family.
You got to wonder if he had heard of MKUltra or anything like that, in the way the government used acid to reprogram people.
You know, I don't know if that was very big, but I mean, I know it was going on back then, but I don't know if it was very public back then.
You have to wonder, well, I mean, as much time as he spent in prison, you probably hear a lot of that kind of scuttlebutt.
Sure.
I wonder if maybe he did.
Yeah.
You never know. In 1952, in his last act of criminal violence before the 1969 murders, Manson sodomizes a boy while holding a razor to his throat. He's transferred to the federal reformatory at Petersburg, Virginia. Later in 52, Manson is moved to a more secure reformatory in Chillicothe, Ohio.
That's an interesting fact. Is after this period, like you said, that was his last violent, the thing that he was arrested for that involved any kind of violence.
Sure.
Manson was an anomaly in that he, as an adult, he spent most of his time in prison. But he kept getting sent to prison for stuff that they were minor offenses. It was like pimping, forgery, robbery, but
the most
minor
felonies enough to.
And yeah, for some reason, he came before judges that just threw the book at him for things that other people would have gotten, you know, minor.
He just happened to be probably the guy they set an example with more than once for whatever reason, just unlucky number that day.
Yep. And that's why he spent, you know, when they let him out in 67, he said, I don't want to leave. This is where this is my home.
It's like Brooks and what was that? Shawshank.
Right.
Except he didn't go Brooks's way. He kind of went another psychotic way. Make no mistake, though, Brooks was kind of psychotic to hang himself. But that's a whole other story. Let's see. 56, Manson is sentenced to 3 years imprisonment at San Pedro, California for violating the terms of I skipped something. Sorry. 1955, Manson marries Rosalie Willis, a waitress from Wheeling. The couple produces a child, Charles Manson Jr., who apparently, Manson worked as a parking lot attendant and a busboy and stealing cars. In October, he's arrested for auto theft and sentenced to 5 years probation. Is this kid still alive?
Charles Manson Jr. doing these days?
He actually committed suicide a few years ago.
Nothing then.
So he basically said the kids of Charles Manson had a rough way to go. I mean, a couple of them have lived under assumed names or just started new lives and have done pretty well.
I can kind of sympathize there because our dad in Wood River is kind of an infamous name with the police. So a few times in my dealings with the police, I I'm junior. I have the junior name there. So, I know your dad. I've had everything you can imagine said to me.
Yeah.
So I feel their pain. It's not their fault they are who they are.
Yeah.
So it's kind of tragic the kid had to kill himself and whatever other kind of pains they went through just because their dad chose the life he chose. Well, maybe he didn't choose it, but his life was his life, and it directly impacted theirs.
Right.
Pretty much a bummer. So in 56, he was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment in San Pedro, California for violating the terms of his 55 probation. 58, he gets divorced, and his wife retains custody. And Manson is released on parole to become a pimp in Southern California. That's a weird business for that guy to get into.
Did he have the X carved in his head yet?
No, that was done during the trial. That was a statement he was making that he was being crossed out of society.
Oh. Yeah.
His philosophy was still kind of being formed in his head at this point.
Right. So he's like a buddy now, Ron Hubbard, coming up with Dianetics. You didn't get that one, did you?
No, I actually didn't hear it. I'm sorry.
Pay attention to your chat then.
L. Ron Hubbard, the guy that did that started Scientology.
We're past that. We're past it. You missed it.
What's that?
Yeah, I see that. Okay, let's see. 59, Manson is arrested for forging a treasury check and given a 10-year suspended sentence. He didn't get the book thrown at him there. But let's go on. 1916, marries again, this time to a 19-year-old.
To be clear, how old is he right now when he marries the 19-year-old?
Let's see. 1960, he would have been 26.
Well, that's not too bad. And how old was he when he sodomized the boy?
He was 17, I think.
Yeah, he was just near the end of his juvenile run.
This guy's a creep.
No. You're just coming to this conclusion?
Yeah.
Moving on. You're killing me today. You know
talk
that?
About an open mind, huh?
Wow. Okay, 58, he's divorced, married again. Okay, yeah, he married this 19-year-old. In April, he's indicted on federal Mann Act charges, M-A-N-N. What is the Mann Act, do you know? Put you on the spot here.
You know what? I don't know.
Let's find out.
Yeah, we've got Google. We can figure that shit out.
The Mann Act was...
That might be the first I've heard of that.
Signed into law by President Taft in 1910, the act made it a crime to transport women across state lines for the purpose of prostitution or debauchery.
Ah,
it's because he was pimping.
I didn't know that's what it was. Yeah, I didn't know that's what it was called.
Me either. The Mann Act, huh? Well, that's what you get, Chuck. Shouldn't have been a pimp.
Yep.
So he's arrested in Laredo.
He's coming after you now. You called him Chuck.
Yeah, I wonder if he's going to hear this podcast.
In prison? We're real big in prison.
Is that right?
Not yet. I assume in a few
years. We will be.
That's right. Anyway, he's arrested and brought back to California, where he's ordered to prison to serve a 10-year sentence that had been suspended in 1959. So that's whenever he got his probation. They're saying, nah, you fucked up. Back
now
on
you
got
to serve the rest of your sentence.
Yep.
61, he's transferred to a federal pen in McNeil Island in Washington, where he claims to be a Scientologist. There we go. Prison psychiatrists say he has deep-seated personality problems.
I could see that.
That's interesting. 63, after fathering his second child, Charles Luther Manson. Ah, not a junior. He's gone the
George Foreman route.
We'll have a talk about this later. Me and my wife have been arguing about how George Bush isn't. It isn't George Bush Senior and Junior.
No, but it's George Bush Senior. It's not. He's not a senior, but it's George Bush Senior.
No, he's not.
No, it's. I know he's not. It's not part of his name, but it's not. It's George Bush Senior.
Just let it go. You guys are both wrong.
Well, his next kid. I guess he had a Charles and a Charles, and his next kid is Pooh Bear. So, wow. You know, do you want to be Charles or do you want to be Pooh Bear?
I'll take Charles.
Yeah,
I'll take Charles.
Yeah.
Sorry, Pooh. In 64, he becomes obsessed with the music of the Beatles and learns to play the steel guitar.
Yeah, now that sounds more about what I know, like because he was more obsessed with the Beatles. I didn't know much about the Beastie Boys. Mike D. I didn't know much about the Beatle or the Beastie Boy. God, fuck you, Everett. I didn't know much about the Beach Boys until
Fred says about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you didn't do any research this time.
Well, you know, I've been busy.
I know. It's your kid's birthday week.
Well, Beatles obsession thing in 64, I think that's kind of bullshit because that's, you know, the Beatles were
barely
still,
had become big in America.
Well, they were pop, and he really got interested once they started expanding into the psychedelic, sure. You know, psychedelic stuff. So.
Anything after Sgt. Pepper, probably.
Right around that time. Yeah.
Let's see. 66, Manson aspires to become a songwriter, devotes most of his spare time in prison to the task. Fair enough. That's what I would do in prison too. Get ripped and learn to play the guitar.
I mean, that sounds like a great plan.
Yeah, whenever I finally go, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
In March 21st, 1967, he asked prison officials to let him remain in prison after having completed his 10-year in prison, but he is released.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he asked to be.
Yeah, he told them, don't let me out. And they forced him to go.
Wow.
Yeah. Oops.
Like, so you hear one thing about the guy, then you hear another thing about the guy. It's like, he didn't want to leave prison? Like, okay, so wait a minute. He's not crazy. But that's fucking crazy. Like, you're done. Go home.
Think about it. At this point in his life, he's been in prison way over half his life, from juvenile facilities.
He's institutionalized then.
He's completely institutionalized.
And he knew it. And so he said, I think you guys need to let me stay where I'm at. And they're like, no, you're done. So we got to get rid of you. So they kicked him out, and he went to San Francisco and started the family.
Huh. I bet those guys are kicking their cell.
Yeah, that's what I'm like.
The thing about it is, people in those positions, they would never accept responsibility for that.
Well, right.
Oh, that's true.
You're right.
Okay, let's see. 1968, December, the Beatles released the White Album, which proves to be a great influence on Manson's thinking, obviously, because Helter Skelter.
Yeah.
All right. March 29th, 1969, Manson visits 10,050 Cielo Drive, the Tate residence, looking for Terry Melcher, who he had hoped might publish his music. Tate's photographer curtly tells Manson to leave by the back alley, possibly supplying a motive for a later attack at the Tate home. That's interesting.
Yeah.
They spurned him, and he's like, oh, I'll be back.
It gets very, very complicated because there are so many different variations and you know, different motives that people think triggered the murders, and that's just one aspect. I really don't put a lot of credence into that because I think that he was there and he was pissed off because Terry wasn't there, and Terry Melcher was the son of Doris Day, and he lived in the house with Candace Bergen before Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski moved in, so he had been there, and he was pissed off because Terry was reneging on some of the what Manson said were promises.
Sure, probably what he told him to get him away from him at the time.
That's kind of what Terry Melcher presented it as, is, you know, I was just kind of telling him whatever he and Dennis Wilson wanted to hear so I could get him away from me.
Right.
Why does that name sound so familiar? Candace Bergen.
She was an actress. She played on what was that big show she had?
Was she Murphy Brown?
Murphy Brown.
Murphy Brown. Yeah. Okay, all right, and that's the daughter of Doris Day?
No, it was Terry Melcher was her boyfriend, and he was the son of Doris Day.
And he was the son of Doris Day. Okay.
He was actually also Doris Day's manager. He wrote some of her songs, too.
Oh, okay. Good deal. So, I'm glad you know a lot about this.
Well, that's why we asked him here today.
Well, right, yeah.
Kind of a coincidence, huh?
Yeah. So, but I mean, you know, Manson being told, you know, being kicked off the property because who he was looking for doesn't live there anymore is not, I mean, even for Manson, that doesn't seem to me to be a feasible reason as why
the only thing I can think of is as a guy in prison, an act of disrespect like that in prison would incur some wrath, some eventual wrath.
I think that the main reason that may have played a part.
Sure.
I think the main reason that he chose that house was because he and Tex had been in there. They knew the layout of the house, and that, you know, that's important. So I think that's why he picked that house that night.
Fair, that's fair. I mean,
and it was also to get a message to Terry Melcher. I think he was. He knew that Terry Melcher didn't live there anymore, but he knew that
he would hear about that, and he knew who did live there.
Yeah, so. Exactly. It was his way of saying, "Look, I can come and find
this,
you."
This
at any
could
time.
Have been you,
right?
That's messed up.
So yeah, calculated is probably a really good word to describe him if he's doing shit like that. He's very calculated.
That's like stuff Mafia does.
Yeah,
sending messages.
Messages.
We won't kill you. We'll kill your family or people around you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess he still thought he might have been able to get something out of him, or would have been able to. Isn't that weird? What could he thought he could have possibly gotten at that point? We've murdered all these people. It's surely going to come to light that we're involved.
I mean, how could it not?
Right. I guess maybe he wasn't thinking that far ahead.
Well, they believed that the Black Panthers were going to be blamed for it.
Well, because they wrote pig on the wall.
Right. And they put a paw print on the first guy that they
I read that. That's right.
Gary Hinman, they put a paw print on the wall in blood and hoping that, you know, people would think that the Black Panthers did it.
So this was all to start. He did this to try to start a race war, but he did it for his own reasons.
Camouflage.
But as a okay, so he did it. Camouflage was the race thing.
Right. Well, yes, the prosecutor, and he believes that the main motivation was because Manson believed that there was going to be a race war between the blacks and the whites. The blacks would ultimately win. And Manson and his family would be in hiding. And at the end of the war, when the black people were the only ones left, he was going to come up with his family and they were going to rule the world because black people are too dumb to be able to rule the world on their own. That's what he thought.
This sumbitch had plans.
That's what the prosecutor said was the main motivation for the murders. The family says that the main motivation for the murders was because Gary Hinman was murdered by some members of the family. One of them got arrested and was in jail. And the family decided to commit copycat murders that were similar so that they would release the family member that was in jail for the first murder.
Wow.
Yeah, that was on July 31st, 1969, whenever they killed Gary Hinman.
Yeah.
So on August 8th, 1969, now we're getting into the big time, the ones that everybody knows about. Manson tells his family members, now is the time for Helter Skelter. That evening, he tells Patricia Krenwinkel, Susan Atkins, Tex Watkins, Watson, God, I'm killing myself today, and Linda Kasabian to get knives and changes of clothes. And he sends them from the ranch on their mission, telling them to leave a sign, something witchy. And Watson drives them to the Tate residence. So at the Tate residence, there's, what, 5-6 people there that night? There's the guy outside in the car, which whenever they get there, first things first, Tex goes up to take a look around, see what's going on.
There was a teenager that just, I mean, he was there visiting the caretaker.
Yeah, the groundskeeper or whatever.
And he just happened to be leaving just as they were arriving. So it was just the worst
no
timing.
Witnesses. So he shoots him a couple times. What surprises me is the neighbors heard all the gunshots. But apparently nobody called the police.
They did call. There were people that called the police. The problem is, and if you see where the house is, you kind of understand. It's on a hillside,
right?
And there are houses. I mean, right there. I mean, it's kind of on the hillside, kind of up on its own, like kind of like the bluffs on the river road. But then just down the road, there's houses, you know, close by.
They lived in L.A., right? Was it close to like the Hollywood? Close to Hollywood?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so they lived real in familiar L- with that area.
Yeah.
So.
It was in not Topanga Canyon, Laurel Canyon.
Sure.
So everything else was down at the bottom. Well, the way that the houses are set up and the way that the hills are, the sounds bounce around.
Right, resonate real bad echoes.
So people heard firecrackers. They heard screams. They heard, but they were like, you know, I heard a scream and it's coming. It sounds like it's coming from the block over, or it sounds like it's coming from down further in the valley somewhere. Well, the sounds were all bouncing around, so nobody knew where the sounds were coming from.
Right.
And there were people way down in the canyon that heard very clearly screams and moans and no, oh God, stop.
Jesus.
The neighbors would hear what one neighbor described it as, I think, firecrackers. So it's just the sounds are really weird in a canyon like that, and they bounce around, so nobody really knew where they were coming from.
One of our listeners makes a really good point about what you were just saying, Fred. He says, too dumb to rule the world, but smart enough to win a race war. And he's talking about colored people as well. He said, you know, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, if you think about it, he thought that they were too dumb to rule the war, but they were still smart enough to win a complete race war against whites.
You know? The way he saw it is the way he termed it. And I mean, I'm using terms that he would use.
That his terms. Okay.
Yeah, not necessarily
our words,
that
people.
I would use.
Right.
But he says that the blacks have been down for too long. It's their turn to put Whitey up on the cross. So he said, you know, the LA riots, Watts riots.
Watts, yeah.
Were indications of what was coming, that at some point the black man was just going to rise up, that they've had enough of the discrimination and the abuse.
Right.
That they were going to rise up and just rebel, and they would actually unite. And there would be a big war between the blacks and the whites. Well, the whites would be unprepared for it, so it would, you know, kind of even the odds out a little bit. The Black Panthers would be in hiding, kind of like Manson and his family.
Uh-huh.
And when the tide started to turn and the white race was vulnerable, the Black Panthers were going to come up and just wipe them all out.
Really? Huh.
So.
That dude's crazy.
Wow, yeah, very crazy.
But his thoughts are very similar to, you ever listen to Louis C.K.'s comedy?
Yeah, oh yeah.
He says the exact same thing about how black or whites are going to pay eventually. He says, right now it's great, we're living the high life, but eventually they're going to hold us down and rape us.
Right.
And we deserve it.
And we deserve it.
Whee!
Well, it's interesting because that's what, I mean, and this is a whole other subject, but I was born into a religious cult. It was a nonviolent cult. It wasn't anything like the family, but it was their interpretations of the Book of Revelation was very similar to Manson's as far as the end of the world, how it would come about, things like that. And so as a teenager, I just found the book Helter Skelter and I read it. And it was weird because I'd never thought of it before. I'd never been exposed to it before, but I read how this man who interpreted the Bible similar to the cult that I was in, and people were like, this guy's batshit crazy. And I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute.
This is what I've been taught.
So is there something? And that was actually the first step toward me realizing, you know, I was like 13, 14 at the time, realizing that, oh, these people are crazy.
This isn't normal. Everyone doesn't live this
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Yeah.
What kind of if you don't mind me asking, what was up with your cult?
Well, it's just there were a lot of parallels.
Did you guys live on a compound or a commune of some sort? Or?
No, but we were kept pretty isolated.
Sure.
And it was in this area, but we lived among, you know, the world.
Gotcha.
But their interpretation of the end time, they were obsessed with the end times, and they had a prophet that would, you know, tell us, you know, all mm-hmm. the stuff that was going to happen and when the end of the world was going to happen and everything. But the similarities between the way Manson interpreted it and the way this group interpreted it were very similar. We believed that we were going to be leaving to go and hide in a place of safety while the big, you know, war of all wars was happening, and that God was going to come and get us when that was over with, and we were going to, you know, basically rule the world. And I mean, there was a lot of similarities. So
that's almost the line of almost every cult, though. There's something going down. We're going to be
that's
okay.
True.
And God's going to come save us.
And I guess if you're brought up into that from childhood on, it doesn't seem that far-fetched
exactly.
and outlandish until you actually get
indoctrination.
Exactly.
One way or the other.
I knew we were different, but I thought we were different because we were lucky. But then, you know, Helter Skelter was my first indication that, no, we're not lucky. We're just
child's minds
crazy.
Are more susceptible to indoctrination. Cortana said that, remember?
What was it?
A child's mind's more susceptible to indoctrination.
All right, it's a blank slate.
Yeah.
He's talking about a video game we play where there's a secret government thing that happened where they kidnapped a bunch of 6-year-olds and turned them into soldiers. It's really interesting.
Huh.
Very. Very. I think Keith Daly, he says, what was up with your cult? Well, he's talking about whatever.
We've just been over there, Keith. Thank you.
No, he's laughing at what you said to him. What's up with your cult?
He was making fun of me? That's fine. I'm going to ban you.
That was great.
Okay, let's see. Where were we at here? Shortly after midnight on August 9th, the brutal attack on the residents at the Tate residence begins. In all, 102 stab wounds are inflicted on four victims, and a fifth victim is shot.
Jesus Christ.
Left dead are actress Sharon Tate, who was 8.5 months pregnant. I was telling you about that. That's crazy. How could you kill somebody that pregnant?
You really got to have no conscience.
I mean, you could ask, how could you kill anyone? But even then, whenever somebody's got a baby bump that looks like a beach ball. Mm.
Did they stab her in the belly? I mean, I know that's kind of gruesome.
Probably. That's one of the urban legends is that they actually tore the baby out.
Right,
out
I've Sharon heard Tate. That.
Yeah, and it's not true. The baby was not touched. And in fact, if police had gotten there within the hour, they could have saved the baby. The baby would have lived.
Yeah, really? It was probably at that point suffocated.
And
without any blood, you know, replenishing the oxygen in its
right,
body.
Right, right. Wow. But... yeah, they actually were arguing over what to do with her. And I believe it was Patricia Krenwinkel that said, you know, look, Manson was clear about what we were supposed to do, so you need to either kill her or shut up. And Tex and Sadie, I think, were kind of arguing about what to do about it. And then Sadie, Susan Atkins, has given conflicting stories. Sometimes she would say that they wanted to cut the baby out and, you know, like smear it against the wall and everything, but they didn't have the time. But then after that, she was also saying that she felt like she needed to cut the baby out and possibly even bring it back to Manson, save it and bring it back to Manson and the family. But she just couldn't bring herself to do it. So it's, you know, nobody really knows what the plans were with the baby.
There's the question. Is the kid better off having died or been taken back to the Mansons? That kid could have been you, Fred.
That's true.
I almost feel like I need a shower.
that's some messed up stuff, though. Another dead was Jay Sebring, Wojtek Frykowski. Mm-hmm. I love that name, Wojtek. I don't know why.
Wojtek.
Mm-hmm.
Abigail Folger, who was the heiress to the Folgers' coffee fortune.
Yeah.
Oh, and really?
Stephen yep. Parent.
Yeah, Stephen Parent was the teenager in the car.
Yeah, he was just Jay Sebring. Wrong place, wrong time.
Jay Sebring was the main hairstylist of the Stars back then.
It was Tate's personal stylist too.
Yeah, and he and Sharon Tate were actually engaged at one time. And when she met Roman Polanski, she dropped Jay, but they stayed friends. But when he died is when Vidal Sassoon kind of took over. So everybody, all these women running around might have Jay Sebring hairdos instead of Vidal Sassoon.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that that Manson story got so? It's so popular because everyone that was involved is in some aspect in Hollywood. Like you said, you think that's why this thing is so prevalent, you know, as it is now, is because everyone that was involved, like you said, you had actresses, they were, Doris Day's son, and then Candace Bergen, all those people everything's all involved with, like, Hollywood. I mean.
I think that kind of like the different motives for the murders, I think that there are several reasons why it's so popular. One of the reasons is because there were so many celebrities involved.
Right.
It happened in Hollywood. I also think that it's because that's when, you know, a lot of people term it as when the 60s died. There was this idealism that the Flower Children held on to that, you know, we're making a difference. We're going to change the world. This is going to happen. And, you know, we're going to rise up against Nixon and, you know, all this kind of this feel of rising up against the establishment and that, you know, things are going to get better. And this was a time period when people didn't lock their doors.
Right.
You know, they didn't worry about walking down a street at night. I mean, this was the 60s when the majority of people didn't think about crime showing up in their living room. So the Manson murders was the pinnacle. That's the turning point where it went from, you know, people trusting their fellow man and trusting in, you know, the environment that they're in to locking their doors, getting guard dogs, you know.
That makes sense.
Distrusting other, you know, other groups of people. And that really, it really was the death of the 60s is what a lot of people think. So that's one of the reasons, too, why.
The whole free love movement, the hippies, that whole thing died hard. Between that, the downturn of San Francisco, the way that more or less became criminals out there looking to take advantage of the hippies that were out there. They were, you know, legit. Then you have Altamont in December.
Yep.
That it died hard is the only
thing. Well, what I'm thinking is, like, there had to have been other crazy people, the serial killers that have done cultish shit killed people in their country somewhere, but it's not as popular as the whole Manson story. The whole Manson debacle made it.
It was just so bizarre, over the top bizarre, even by serial killer standards. It was just so weird, and people had such a hard time understanding how these, you know, teenagers who, you know, were good kids were able to be were able to transition to cold-blooded killers. It was just so alien to people. They weren't exposed to what, you know, we're exposed to today. We're kind of immune to, you know, we see Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad and you know, and The Sopranos. And so we're used to seeing the dark side of humanity. But in 1968, 69, a lot of people had not
seen
the dark side.
You were used to seeing the Brady Bunch.
The worst thing people had seen was
Vietnam.
Vietnam and the murders of Kennedy. Well, not really Kennedy, but what's his name? Lee Harvey Oswald. That was a big thing.
Yeah. That was live on TV.
TV wasn't huge. There was no cable back in the day either. So whenever you got this trial on TV of all these flamboyant, you know, crazy people, so to speak, people are going to take notice.
Right. And yeah, when you ask somebody, you know, did you murder this person or did you stab them 28 times? And their response is, yes, I did.
Yeah, well, sure.
And no remorse, no feeling or anything.
Yeah, yeah. That's
just
crazy.
It was necessary, so I did it.
I'm sure at the time that everybody in the country is asking, are these people legitimately crazy? Is it just a put on? I'm sure everyone had their opinion at the time. I wish I could have been around just to see the way the culture, you know, the way the country reacted and felt, the fear even.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that these people that were in the family were, before they met Charles Manson, crazy or just so open to impressed, you know?
There's some that were probably criminals, but not like...
There were some members of the family that were ex-cons that were, you know, that had a history of violence or, you know, antisocial behavior.
But none were clinically insane?
No. And a lot of them were, you know, Tex Watson, who was the main killer, was voted most likely to succeed. He was a football hero in his hometown.
Wow.
Patricia Krenwinkel had planned to become a nun. Susan Atkins nursed her mom while her mom was dying of cancer. I mean, these were good kids.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like people were tearing frogs apart or burning ants with a magnifying.
Well, that makes me think, like, you know, my 16-year-old self, I was probably able to be impressioned on as much as the next person. Had I met someone like Charles Manson, would I have ended up? You know what I mean? Because I'm thinking, like, I'm not clinically insane, but neither were these people.
Yeah.
They just met this guy that knew how to talk to him and knew how to, you know, manipulate him very well. Like, they were just open to that, you know?
Yeah, I think the majority, because there were a lot of little Charles Mansons all over California. There were tons of communes and cults that were popping up all over. And I think that it's not as much about the kids as it was about him. I think no matter who, if these kids had ended up going with a different guru, if they had met somebody else before Manson, their lives would have ended up totally different, I believe.
Okay.
I don't think there was something that, you know, was necessarily ingrained in them. I think there might have been some antisocial tendencies in people like Patricia Krenwinkel because of her hard childhood.
Right, but nothing that couldn't have been overcome.
Yeah, but nothing that would have been brought out on its own the way that Manson was able to tap into it and expose it and say, look, this isn't bad. This isn't wrong. This is who you are, and you need to express it. There's nothing wrong with you being yourself.
Wow. So that just notes to how good of a manipulator that he was. He took people that were not even bad not bad people per se, just, you know, and turned them into murderers, you know.
When you throw a lot of LSD into somebody like that,
it depends on how much you think of a lot, because it's not, I mean, I've done that before, and it's not, I never thought about killing anyone.
Well, yeah, but if you take 10 hits of acid, like, I can't even believe they thought 10 hits would be enough to kill that lady.
No, but we got to be serious, though, because like a hit nowadays is like what one hit back then is four, you know, because it's like four, but that was just one.
One thing he would do, too, is he would take, you know, he'd give everybody a tab of acid. He would take a half dose. And then he was still coherent, and then when their minds are open to outside influences, that's when he would preach his philosophy. And he was also just he was incredibly good at figuring out, and this came from his years in prison. He was really good at figuring out what somebody needed what hole they had in their life. If, you know, there were a lot of the girls were runaways. Well, naturally, it was probably because they were little hippie girls. Their fathers were conservative, so it was headbutting between father and daughter. So he would be a father figure for them.
He was taking care of their daddy issues that they had.
Yeah. If a guy joined the family that was, you know, feeling self-conscious, not feeling very, you know, lucky with women, he'd send his Front Street girls, the most attractive ones, to make them feel like
that's another thing I read about a lot. Is he had these girls that he would basically use as tools. They're his, mm-hmm. they're the hot ones he would send out to curry favor with people.
Mm-hmm. Everything was a tool for him. Drugs were a tool. Women were a tool. Yeah, that's crazy. That's
prison life, basically.
Wow.
He just
manipulate and use what you got.
Yeah, and he just brought it to the forefront.
Yep. So the next morning, the murders were discovered by housekeeper Winifred Chapman. The four family members after the murders returned to the Spahn Ranch, where their Manson criticized them for doing a messy job. What a way to go.
And there's
an asshole.
There's actually there's an argument. There's a pretty strong argument that Manson actually went back to the house that night. And I think that there's a possibility that he did. He wanted to see, and he said that he did in his autobiography. He wrote that, you know, and you got to take everything he says with a grain of salt.
Right.
But I think in this case, there's a good chance that he did. I think he wanted to go back, and he said he wanted to see what his children had done. So he went back and kind of messed with the crime scene a little bit and brought probably one of his family members with him. There are two people that they think are likely candidates for who he brought with him to go back to the crime scene, one of which is one of the family members that I'm still in touch with on a regular basis.
Which one's that?
Bruce Davis. And so, yeah, I think that there's a chance that the curiosity got the better of him and he went and checked it out.
Now, not that this is either here or there, but did he have sex with everyone in the family? I mean, is that?
He used sex. He had sex with most of the women. A lot of times he would have sex with a woman when he was bringing her in to join the family. But here again, that kind of fell into he really looked at what people needed. His personal preference was for young girls. He liked girls that were like 12, 13 years old. That's kind of his favorite group.
He'd have been big in Pizzagate.
But he was good at figuring out what kind of sexual hangups they had. And one of the things that would happen with someone when they joined the family is he would play on whatever sexual hangups they had, and he would force them to do whatever kind of sex was they were scared of. Or, you know, if one of the first things he would do, whether it was a boy or a girl that joined the family, is he would have them have sex with somebody of the same sex to break down those homosexual taboos.
If you can get them to do something simple like that, that's just breaking down walls in your mind of things you didn't think you could do.
Right.
Right. And, if somebody came with a virgin, that was a virgin and came to the family, he would have an orgy. And the main purpose of the orgy was to, you know, and introduce this virgin to every sexual experience you could possibly do. So he was able to tap into that as well. And I don't think he used the women, you know, people think that he just had the women around him because he wanted to have sex with all of them all the time. Like Leslie Van Houten is one of the prettiest girls that he had, and he only had sex with her a couple times. He didn't need to continue doing that because she had her own hangups that he was able to exploit and everything. So it just depended on what he needed to do to get those people under his wing. And sometimes it involved sex, and sometimes it didn't.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't all about that.
Right.
Okay.
There's one and it's funny because the different family members see the family differently because Manson was able to keep them kind of separate enough to where they saw their own version of the family. There was one family member who said that there was a lot of homosexuality that went on within the family and that he had a sexual relationship with Charles Manson on a fairly regular basis. Tex Watson, on the other hand, said, I never saw any homosexual activity with anybody while I was there.
The name like Tex, he's not admitting much.
But I think that it's because Manson provided for the first guy what he thought the first guy needed or wanted or what he needed to keep this guy under his control. Tex, the that wasn't a hangup for him, so he didn't need to. He, as long as Tex was happy with the girls, that's all Tex needed to know. So, I, again, they just whatever.
So every member needed. Likely had a different view of what this was to them.
Right. And Leslie, after the murders, she said that all along she thought that everybody was in on the plan to kill people and to start a race war and everything. And she came back the next day after the LaBianca killings and told another girl, another family member, about what they had done. Well, she got in trouble for that, and she's like, wait a minute. Isn't everybody all one? Aren't we all?
At that point, they thought everything that came out of his mouth was a complete truth. He would never lie.
Right.
And everything's on the level.
And she's like, so that was when I realized, well, okay, there's some of the family doing this, some of the family doing that. We're not all one because Manson was able to present to each person what he wanted them to see. And, you know, Leslie saw the first time that, oh, maybe everybody's not willing to go out and kill people.
Wow. Just crazy, crazy level of manipulating. You know, his skills with other people are just...
I look at it and I'm tired just from looking at it because I'm thinking to try to keep like 40 or, you know, however many people were in the family at the time and try to keep them all happy, keep them all...
That's a lot of relationships you got
to... And yeah, wow. and using drugs for some, sex for some, intimidation for some, you know, nurturing for some. I'm like, you'd have to keep... like a log to keep track of who needs to do what. So yeah, that would have been a full-time job.
And you say you didn't think that his IQ was too crazy off the charts high, right?
No. I in fact, his IQ was very average. I don't remember what it was, but it wasn't anything astounding. It was just...
What is average, Everett?
I don't know, right around 100. Let me Google it, though, because I don't want to be an asshole. Somebody correct me on the later.
I did a couple of those internet IQ tests.
Oh yeah, did you? Yeah. What are you, 130, it said.
130, yeah.
130. That's what they all say.
Is it really?
Everybody's 130 because that's
don't
genius.
Don't fuck me around. Yeah, is that
130,
right?
130,
135. Oh, now I feel bad.
Yeah, let's see.
For real?
Yeah. 68% of the population is between 85 and 115, so we'll call that. That's the average range.
Okay.
Pretty much a huge range. IQ is bullshit anyway. It's so subjective. it's about test taking.
Yeah.
We're not going to get into that. Maybe one day we do a show on IQ and... make you show what your low IQ really is.
We should have somebody come in and IQ test us and see who's smarter between you and I.
Ooh, boy, that'd make you cry.
One of your listeners asked about Manson, if he was influenced by Aleister Crowley. I'm sure that he had some of that that played into his philosophy. And in fact, Bobby Bousillet, one of his followers, was really involved with Kenneth Anger, who was an avid follower of Aleister Crowley. So I think that they, yeah. And plus that was just so popular at the time. I mean, in the Haight-Ashbury area in LA, in the late 60s, there was a real interest in Satanism and everything, so.
What's the guy that ran Satanism? We did a show all about him.
Anton LaVey.
Anton LaVey. Yeah. Yep.
That guy was a nut. You got to love him, though. So it says here, later that night, Manson, along with Patricia Krenwinkle, Tex Watson, Leslie Van Houten, and Linda Kasabian, they drove around looking for potential other victims. So that's whenever you say he likely returned to the house.
No, this was the next night. You're talking about when the LaBiancas were killed.
Right. Okay, so let's go on. On the 10th, in the early morning hours, family members stabbed to death Leno and Rosemary LaBianca. The words death to pigs and helter skelter, spelled incorrectly, are found printed on a wall in a refrigerator door.
You got to think he was probably pissed about that spelling error.
Probably. Did you take your dictionary or your copy of the White Album?
It's not that hard. We listen to this every day, okay?
It's my one rule. You listen to the White Album daily.
Every day.
Skipping today is your birthday because we don't believe in birthdays.
Scott Albany says his IQ was said to be above 120. So
that's what they say.
That's a possibility. Like I said, I don't remember. I know I read what his IQ was when he was tested at some point, but I don't remember for sure what it was. So that's a possibility.
You any reason why they might have chosen the LaBiancas?
The LaBianca house was chosen pretty much at random. What happened was Charlie intended to split into two groups, and both groups were going to go out and commit some killings. So he dropped off the first group. Well, they drove around for a while as one big group. this is really kind of eerie and disturbing is, you know, one thing that the prosecutor said in his book, Helter Skelter, is he said, you know, that night nobody in L.A. was safe because it was totally at random. So they were driving around. Anybody could have been murdered. They pulled up to a car at a stop sign. And Manson got out and was going to kill the driver of the car next to him. And then the light turned green and they sped off. That's the only thing that saved him. He went to another house and there were pictures that children had drawn. And he came back and said, you know, I don't want to do children. We might have to do that later, but I don't want to kill children. So we're not going to do that house. So that's the only thing that saved them.
Huh.
Then he went to a church and was going to kill the minister and put him up on the cross. But the church was locked because it was too late. So at that point, he drove to the La Bianca house. He had been to some parties at a house next door, so he kind of knew that neighborhood. But he just picked that house at random and then dropped off the killers of the La Biancas. And then he took the other group to Venice and was going to, you know, do some damage there.
And what happened there? They just petered out? Or
He dropped off, again, he wasn't going to do it himself, but he dropped off Linda and Sadie, Susan Atkins, and Clem, and told them to go kill an actor that Linda Kasabian knew in Venice. And Linda Kasabian, who was along the first night, but she didn't kill anybody, she took them to the wrong apartment. And when they realized that they didn't have the right guy, they just hung it up. They didn't go.
Hmm.
They didn't finish it. And then they ended up hitchhiking back to the ranch.
That's just madness. So that's pretty much the end of the spree, so to speak. So here in my timeline, the next thing I have on my timeline is on September 1st, 1969, under a bush near his home, a 10-year-old boy finds the gun that was used in the Tate murders. So in the Tate murders, I thought they only killed the guy outside with the gun. Did they shoot anybody inside the house?
Oh, yeah, they used the gun inside the house. Right. Stephen Parent was shot several times in the car outside, and then Jay Sebring was shot inside, and Wojciech Frykowski was shot, too. In fact, Wojciech Frykowski, I think, was shot twice, beat over the head 13 times, crushed his skull in, and stabbed 51 times. So,
Jesus Christ.
They used the gun with him, too.
Wow, 51 times in one person's body. Per square inch, if you... It's like every this far, you've got a stab mark.
That's crazy.
The amount of time it would take, you'd have to take breaks, wipe off the handle of the blade, because if you... I sound like I've thought about stabbing people and what a bloody blade would be hard to handle, but a bloody blade's hard to handle. You don't want to slip down your knife after you stab somebody and cut your own hand.
To give you an idea of how vicious the murders were, Patricia Krenwinkel, her hand was all bruised up from hitting bone when she was stabbing. And when they killed Lino LaBianca, when the bodies were found, there was a fork. I believe it was the fork.
Neck or something?
In the neck. And yeah. it was so savage that it was coming out the other side of his neck. They stabbed him so viciously that it actually came through the other side.
Man.
So they weren't just, it wasn't just, you know, shot a couple times until they died and then that's it. I mean, these people were definitely mutilated.
Man. I had heard, too, after all this had happened, there was almost an exodus of famous people in Hollywood. Well, not a complete exodus, but people were leaving just because they were afraid they could be them next.
Yeah. With the Sharon Tate murders, people kind of said, well, they're Hollywood, they're weird, they're into black magic, mm-hmm. They're into drugs, so they kind of got what they deserved. Then the next night when the LaBiancas, who were just a typical middle-aged couple, when they were killed, then people freaked out, and they all bought guns, they all started hiring security, people would leave the area, and all of the celebrities were scared to death that they were going to get raided. So they all flushed their drugs down the toilet. And one reporter said the entire L.A. sewer system is stoned.
I would hate to have been a rat living down there at the time, or a homeless person for that matter. Maybe it'd be nice. I don't know. Free drugs coming down all the time.
Yeah.
I'm not too big into drugs, but if they're free.
I want to pass that up.
So let's see what we got here. I want to scrim through this here pretty quick. The trial, let's see. Trial starts. Well, that's weird. I skipped from. I got a real weird timeline here. Hang with me.
No.
October 12th, Manson's arrested near Barker Ranch in Death Valley and charged with Grand Theft Auto. He's put in jail in Independence. November 6th, while incarcerated in Los Angeles on other charges, Susan Atkins tells a fellow inmate that she participated in the Tate murders. What a bonehead move.
That's what got him caught?
That actually broke the case, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I bet
he was pissed. Manson was pissed at her for that.
They believed that. I mean, at this point, they were really out there. I mean, Susan Atkins actually believed that, well, and they all did, that at any time Manson would be able to just snap his fingers, stop time, and they would all just walk out of the jails. So they believed he could literally stop time and they could all get away somewhere.
No shit.
Leslie Van Houten thought that they were going to be angels and she could actually feel the wings sprouting out of her shoulder blades, and she was going to start sewing dresses with pockets that would hold the wings. So they weren't dealing in reality at that point.
Not at all.
Close.
Not
so
at all.
For Susan to brag to her cellmates about what had happened, she didn't think that, you know, that this was going to come back to do what it did. She was just telling them, you know, look, the end of the world is here, and we brought it about, so you better be ready.
Apparently she told the inmate that she told this to Virginia Castro, that there was a death list of other celebrities targeted, including Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Tom Jones, Steve McQueen, and Frank Sinatra,
mm-hmm.
maybe among others. That's pretty nuts if you lost yeah. Tom Jones.
And they had a particular style for each celebrity. They were going to kill them all in a different way.
It's like the religious taboos of
they had
a
celebrity
four.
Hit list for that they were going after all this was done. They were mm-hmm.
And they wow. had. He was just saying they had a different plan to make it like a different scene for every time mm-hmm. they killed one of them. Imagine that's I can't even say that's psychopath. I can't even understand where a person's coming from where you're going to make a statement in this way.
Mm-hmm.
It's art to them, more or less, or probably somewhat art.
Yeah, that's hard to wrap your head around is shit like that. Like, to even, you know, and then, you know, you don't think someone would actually go through with that, but, you know, considering the guy's past and the family's past, I bet they would have if they hadn't got caught. I bet they would have, you know, followed through with all of that shit
sure that
they had planned.
November 12, 69, Al Springer, a visitor to is it Spahn or Spahn Ranch?
Spahn.
Spahn Ranch mm-hmm. tells LAPD detectives that on August 11th or 12th, Charles Manson had bragged about knocking off 5 pigs the other night. So that's a complete lie either on one of their parts, because Manson wouldn't have killed.
Well, Al Springer was a member of the Straight Satan's motorcycle gang, and Manson really wanted the motorcycle, especially after the incident with what he thought was the Black Panther. He felt like the family needed protection.
Yeah, like backup.
And he believed that the bikers would play a part in being his bodyguards when the end of the world came. So he really worked hard to court the bikers, and that's when he would, you know, bring out the, you know, Leslie Van Houtens mm-hmm. and the prettier girls to seduce the bikers. And he would brag to them about all the, you know, the crime.
He's got to seem legit.
Yeah, exactly. And so he would, you know, tell them basically that, and he would build it up and make it even more
right.
spectacular than.
That's what it sounds like if you're knocked off 5 pigs there. And I, yeah.
Yeah.
And I assume the 5 pigs he's talking about were probably not cops, like as I would think a pig would
no,
be.
No, he was talking about the Tate murders.
Okay, good, good, good. Let's see. November 17th, Danny DiCarlo implicates Manson in the Spahn Ranch murder of Shortley Shea.
Shorty Shea, yeah.
Shorty Shea, sorry. Mm-hmm. And also just suggests that persons at Spahn Ranch might have also been responsible for the Tate murders, but he tells the Texas he'd be afraid to testify. So who was Shorty Shea?
Shorty Shea was a ranch hand that lived at the ranch with the family, and he didn't like the family, and he had, you know, been pretty clear about the fact that he thought that the owner of Spahn Ranch should kick them all off the property, and they knew that. So when they were arrested about a week after the murders,
mm-hmm.
well, the family at first freaked out because they thought, oh shit, you know, they found
they got
out
them,
that,
they're probably going to come for us.
Well, they thought, okay, well now they know that we committed the murders. Well, the raid was actually just for Grand Theft Auto. They were just looking at stolen dune buggies that the family
right.
had taken. They had no idea that the family was involved with any murder.
Right, until Susan Atkins had said something.
So, well, and then, so they rounded up the family, arrested them all. Well, within a couple, 3 days, almost all of them were out, and they returned to Spahn Ranch. Well, Manson thought that it was probably Shorty Shea, which may have tipped off the first raid. So that was a revenge killing there.
You can't have no narcs, so to speak.
Yeah. So
it says that at the Spahn Ranch, he didn't allow no watches, clocks, calendars, or reading glass, or any type of glasses,
no.
prescription or no.
No, he would break their glasses when they joined the family, and there was no. He was obsessed with the idea of everything coming to now, where you'd be totally, completely alert, like a. Well, he used the coyote as somebody who, you know, he doesn't think about yesterday, doesn't think about tomorrow. He's highly alert and he's in a state of paranoia all the time. He tried to get the family to be that, to only live in the moment and to not worry about time or space or your surroundings.
If you do that, it takes away consequence.
Fair
enough. And yeah, he eradicated guilt.
Yeah. So. While, if there's no past or future, you have no guilt or consequence. That's the definite way you'd want your soldiers to be. Let's see. Where are we at here? Okay. November 18th, 1969. Prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi. Am I getting that right?
Bugliosi.
Bugliosi. Yeah. Okay. Is assigned the Tate-LaBianca case. July 24th, 1970. What, you got something?
Yeah, I heard that that lawyer, the guy that prosecuted Manson, was a... just an excellent lawyer. And some of my, I interviewed my boss for this, and he was, and that was one of his main points, was make sure that you look into the lawyer that prosecuted Manson. So, because that guy, if he'd have
like
been
a pibble,
huh?
Was he like a pibble?
He said, he said that if had that guy been on the trial whenever OJ had done that, he said that OJ had been in prison. He said that guy was an excellent prosecutor. Is what he was saying. So I mean,
I think he was an excellent. I have some issues with him. I in some of the ways that he went about some of the things that he did, but he gets the job done.
Got the job done.
Yeah.
Oh, he's like a Vic Mackey type of guy, huh?
Right, probably, yeah.
Okay, let's see. July 24th, 1970, the Tate-LaBianca murder trial with defendants Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten opens in L.A. Nary what? Shit.
Yeah,
11 months after the murders?
Tex was fighting extradition in Texas, so he had to be tried separately after.
Tex from Texas.
Yep.
Full Metal Jacket?
Forrest Gump.
Oh, Forrest Gump, man. Let's see. August 10th, a year to the day, Judge Older grants Linda Kasabian immunity from prosecution for the Tate-LaBianca murders in return for agreeing to appear as the prosecution's star witness. Mm-hmm. Boy, I bet he was pissed about that.
Completely
She flipped, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But she was the one that went along but didn't actually kill anybody, right?
Right.
Right.
And she, you know, she was a little more involved than she lets on. She kind of plays the, oh, poor me. I was the just innocent. An innocent little hippie flower girl. And all of a sudden,
how I play.
There's all this death and destruction around me. And I was shocked and didn't know what to do. And I was scared. And no.
They fed me drugs and sodomized me.
Yeah. She was all aboard the whole Manson philosophy. Sure. And I think she was kind of like Leslie. I think once it actually started happening and she saw it and she saw the blood, she was like, oh, I'm in over my head now.
Right. It was fun to play until it got real. Right.
Exactly.
And you'd think as someone as smart and as manipulative as Manson, seeing someone, you would make everyone get their hands dirty. I feel like if you're going in there and you're going to
murder people, one of his directorates. Mm-hmm. Whenever he sent them there, make sure everybody gets their hands dirty.
Exactly. Right. So like, how did she get away without, you know, killing anyone?
I think that once they got there, I think that Tex could tell that she wasn't prepared.
So
he had her basically be the getaway person. She was supposed to stay out with the car. But I think that it's very puzzling. There's a lot of reasons why Linda should not have been there that night. All the other killers had been with him for at least a year, so they had a lot of indoctrination time. She had been with the family for like a month. So, and she didn't exhibit the kind of mindless zombie
loyalty,
obedience that the others did. So she had a driver's license, and she was the only person at the time in the family that had a valid one.
All right, damn it, you'll do.
So, yeah, so they say that that's why she went. That's not a good enough excuse. I'm a little confused as to why Manson would include her, unless he just overestimated how loyal she was to his cause.
I think you could throw out personal infatuation, too. I don't think he would ever let something like maybe he had a crush on her
right.
or whatever influence him to the point where he would use her. Just for that reason.
No.
To impress her or
anything. I don't think so. There are a lot of people wonder why she went that night because she just wasn't cut from the same cloth as the others.
Listener Keith Dale has a question. I assume it's for you and about the prosecutor. I assume it says, what did he do that he has issues with? What did the prosecutor do that you have issues with?
Oh, Bugliosi. Well, I just think that he took on this motive of, and I mean, he was kind of painted into a corner because this was so bizarre and it was so complex that he had to find a motive. And the biggest reason to find a motive was because he had to have that case against Manson.
Right.
all these others, like the copycat killings and everything, it would be so easy for the defense to say, well, you know, this has nothing to do with Manson. These guys went and did this on their own.
Right.
He might have been there influencing them, but he didn't tell them to go kill anybody.
Well,
he didn't
what was his charge? Was it murder by proxy or something similar to that?
No, it was conspiracy to commit murder. But he also was convicted of 7 counts of murder for the LaBianca and the Tate victims, even though he wasn't there.
Good.
Yeah. And so that's what they said, that, you know, the Bugliosi was a really good prosecutor to be able to get that. So he adopted the helter skelter theory. But I just think it was more complex than that. But I think, in my opinion, I think Bugliosi was a little dishonest, because I think he got into it, realized that it was much more complicated than just the helter-skelter race war theory. But he had already gotten so far into it and so deep into it that he couldn't back up and say, well, there's also these other circumstances. So he had to, for the rest of his life, he had to defend his helter-skelter theory. And I think he didn't fully believe it himself. So that kind of... I think I question his character about a few things that are, you know, like in his private life and things like that. But that's the big thing with the Manson case. He did what I think he should have done, which was to convict all of them. But the way he went about it was a little, I mean, he
wishy-washy.
Not wishy-washy. He just presented to the jury what he wanted the jury to see.
Right. All right. November 16th, 1970, the state rests its case. 3 days later, the defense, without having presented any evidence, also rests.
Really?
I guess they're pretty confident.
Well, the defense attorneys were at odds with the women, because Manson decided it was time to basically throw them to the wolves. So he told them to testify that they did it on their own and that he wasn't involved. Well, the defense attorneys were like, we're not going to have any part of my client admitting to murders, especially like Leslie Van Houten was gonna say that she was involved in the Tate murders. Well, she wasn't even there that night. Right. Didn't even know where they were. And they were like, we're not going to play any part of this, so we're just going to rest because we don't want these girls to testify.
I don't blame them.
Right. Like,
there's no way. You could probably even get disbarred for something like that if it comes to light. I don't know.
It's, yeah.
All right, let's see what we got here. Next day, November 20th, Manson announces that he wishes to testify and makes a strange statement saying, the children that come at you with knives are your children. You taught them. I didn't teach them. I just tried to help them stand up. On cross-examination, Bugliosi asked Manson if he thinks he's Jesus Christ. What an interesting question. I guess that's trying to paint him into it.
Try to play his mindset, yeah.
Huh. November 30th.
Wait, what was his answer?
I don't know. I don't have that. I wouldn't think he thinks he's Jesus.
He never said that he was Jesus. In fact, some of his followers say that he never said, I am Jesus Christ. He would always kind of play around it. He would say things like, you know, well, now it's, I've been up on the cross. Now it's society's turn to be up on the cross. Or he would say, you know, one of his favorite things was, will you die for me? So I don't think he ever told them he was Jesus. It's just everybody
indirectly
kind of
made
assumed
those,
that because of his powers and because of what they had seen and believed that he must be the second coming.
Yeah, and you'll have that too with cults. Everybody thinks it's all religious. The guy at the top, he's the new Messiah. Mm-hmm. Yada, 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 yada. What do we got here? The jury, on January 25th, the jury convicts all Tate LaBianca defendants of first-degree murder. Very interesting. Good. I'm glad they all went down. What do we got here? Anything else, Fred, you think it's important about the trial? Any other things? I don't really want to cover after the trial too much because it's more or less boring sitting in prison for 30 years, 15 appeals each. No, or not appeals, parole, you know, tries at parole.
2012, he was denied parole for the 12th time.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, 12.
Yeah. Nothing other than really the fact that, and this is the part where I always get the hate mail.
but ooh, I love hate mail.
Yeah, me too.
There are members of the family that are still in prison that I think should be free. There are members of the family who I think should die in prison.
Leslie Van Houten, she actually was paroled. But had the parole blocked, right?
Leslie and Bruce have both been paroled. And the only reason that the parole was denied, and in some cases the parole's been denied over and over again, is because the governors of California, Jerry Brown and Schwarzenegger mm-hmm. before that, were under so much public pressure keep them in jail. But that's where you start getting into, at what point does celebrity overrule constitutional rights?
I don't think it ever should. Honestly, I mean, if they were paroled Be they believe it or not, if they're paroled by the way the you know the way the system works, they should be let out.
They should be.
The governor shouldn't be able to step in and say, no, I don't agree. It doesn't matter if we've got all these signatures online, if the Tate sisters coming up saying that these people are all still crazy.
Because they still have, like you said, constitutional rights.
They're people. And it's like last week with Pizzagate. I'm quick to defend you. People have rights. You can't just come up and start accusing people based on circumstantial evidence.
You have the right to not be accused?
I think you do. Where is that evidence
in the Constitution again?
Shut up. We're going to fight again.
But I mean, if you take any one of their situations out of the Manson family mythos, and you have a group of people who go out and break into somebody's house, and two of the people murder the residents of the house, a third person who was standing, who basically ran into another room because mm-hmm. they didn't want any part of what was going on. They are brought in and forced to stab a dead body. How much time would they serve in prison for being involved in that crime?
If they weren't involved in the Manson
If it wasn't the Manson
They'd be out.
If you could prove that that's what happened, I'd have trouble convicting them in the first place. Maybe you get an accomplice. You shouldn't have been there. You should have known better to get yourself in that position.
3 to 5.
Maybe.
Yeah. So that's what happened with Leslie Van Houten, and she's been in prison now for 47 years.
No shit.
For that crime. Bruce Davis is basically the same situation. He was with a group of members when they killed Shorty Shea. And he was forced by Manson. Manson gave him a machete and said, you know, and the body was laying there. And Manson said, you know, it was the whole getting your hands dirty thing. He said, take this machete and do your part. And Bruce said, I can't. And Manson said, we'll kill you right now if you don't. So he did.
Hey, give me that machete.
Oh, but that's coercion. I mean, not coercion, but that's like, you know, if you don't do this, we're going to kill you. Yeah. Like, yeah, under duress. There you go. I don't feel like he should have been.
But again, that's my word versus your word. I mean, at the end of the day,
you know,
you're admitted of having put a machete into someone's body. Were they alive? We don't know. Why did you do it? Because Manson said, well, maybe.
Well, but yeah, but with forensic now, like if these murders would happen nowadays, they could tell shit like that, whether or not the person was dead whenever he was hacked with the machete.
Possibly. Well,
possibly, fair enough. I mean, but there's a better shot at them being able to tell more about this case with today's forensics than they would have been back then.
Even beyond all that, the fact that you're associated with Manson right there and with all of the public opinion, that's enough to get a conviction there.
That's all you have to say is that they were a former member of the family.
Right.
And then there's this just overwhelming stigma. It goes beyond logic because they've made Charles Manson more than he was. He was
a
con man.
Oh, yeah.
And they turned him into this, you know, supernatural demon that has the ability to hypnotize the whole world. Mm-hmm. So there's this unnatural, crazy ass fear of anybody that was involved in the family. And I understand that because of the circumstances, but I don't think that it should supersede somebody's right to fair punishment.
Fair trial, yeah.
And I think that in some of the cases, they have been. And the poor people that are members of the family that never committed the crimes or never were convicted of anything that had to start new lives after the trials, some of these people have literally been hounded by the media for 45 years. They will move out of state, change their name, have a family. Somebody eventually finds out who they are. Mm-hmm. And they are exposed in their town. Their town runs them out because they don't want to have a former Manson family member in their community. They have to pick up and start somewhere else. And I mean, these are people they're not dangerous. They're not bad people. They were in a hippie commune and they're
just so happens they picked the wrong one.
Yeah. Right. And their entire lives are ruined. And people misunderstand me all the time and think that I'm defending killers and I'm defending cold-blooded killers.
I get exactly
killers,
what you're saying.
But there are some cases where, like I said, I think they're right where they belong. I think Tex needs to die in prison. Patricia needs to die in prison. Charlie needs to die in prison. But some of these people, I don't think that they deserved what society gave to them in return.
Sure. No, I totally buy that. Totally agree. The only other one thing I want to talk about, we haven't touched yet, strangely, is now he has the Nazi swastika tattoos on his head, but during the trial, it was actually an X he had carved into his head. You want to tell us about what the significance of the X carved into his head was about?
It was just a show of defiance. They were showing that they had X'd themselves out of society. They said that they rejected a man's court that they, you know, answer to a higher call. They believe that, you know, that society is killing the earth,
right?
And that they didn't want to play a part, that that this was, you know, the whole trial and everything was just a big game. It was a big joke, and they wanted to, you know, show their lack of involvement.
Sure.
They had X'd themselves out of the world. They didn't see themselves as
being tried by a system and a society that they don't even belong to. And they'd shave their heads before they did that. It was a wild. Have you seen the pictures of those women walking in? Right in the middle of their forehead, shaved it. It's a wild thing. And to see that live at the time, too, that's going to really increase the mysticism behind this, the mystique.
Well, that's why I think all these people get, like, you know, they're all crazy. That's why everyone, you know, when you hear Manson, it's crazy, crazy. All the people are crazy. Like shit like that. They walk into the courtroom and they'd shave their heads. They've carved X's into their foreheads. Like, what other conclusion are you coming to at this point? You know what I mean? Especially back in the 70s.
It like this. If you were to need a quick army and you had to go a place to get it, would you go down to your local hotel and grab who's ever in there? Would you go down to the local nut house?
Church.
Well, church is one way to go, but that's a whole different thing. I would go
I'm just saying, that's where I'd go if I needed an army.
Never mind that question. Just I moved a strike, whatever. You guys got anything else you want to throw in on this?
I just had to note the one thing that I thought was very funny, that he said that Scientology was too crazy for him.
Should be the only review they need on the Scientology.
That should be
website.
If you ever were like on the fence about Scientology at all,
Charlie
Manson said that Scientology was too crazy.
In one
crazy
way, that
for
might
him.
Pull people in.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you seen Leah Remini's show about Scientology?
No, there's a guy in the office here, though, that's watched it. He says it's excellent.
Oh, it is. It is. And I mean, I knew a lot about Scientology because I've just studied cults quite a bit. And everything. But I mean, I've learned a ton of stuff from watching her show because it's just so. The extremes that some of these groups will go to protect their reputation or protect their membership is just insane.
Yeah, the stuff I've heard about Scientology is nuts. The secret, like you said, the secretism. They've got the giant compound they've been building out in the desert. They've got their own jails that'll put people in.
You know how they obtain their tax-free exempt status?
Blackmail.
Yes.
Yeah. We're going to have to do a show about Scientology one of these days.
Yes, they did. They infiltrated the IRS, the FBI, something to the tune of like 5,000 people got blackmailed so that they could get that status, a tax-exempt status.
Way to go, Tom Cruise and John Travolta.
Right.
Blame you.
Yeah. Oh, they totally groom like people, like groom them for your wife, like Katie Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
Didn't work on her.
No, Tom Cruise sucks anyway.
Yeah. Yes, he does. Agreed.
He hasn't did shit since Legend, and I'm going to stick with that.
Legend was an excellent movie.
Well, Interview with a Vampire.
You're right. I love that movie. He did a great Lestat.
Yeah.
Way better than the Lestat they had in Queen of the Damned.
Oh, yeah.
Top Gun was good.
It was okay.
It was better.
It was a popcorn movie.
Cult classic, I guess.
What? It's no cult classic. You don't know what cult classic means then.
I'm not prepared to argue this point.
It was a blockbuster in 1986. That's not how
it gets. See what I got to deal with?
All right. I'm getting my blood pressure up. People are going to stop listening again. Yeah. All right, let's call
Hang on. I got a list of shout-outs we got to go through here. Some people that have been helpful in the group and on the page this week and even in the chat. So Chris Dabney, thank you.
He's going to be sending us some pins and ashtrays, so that's
really cool. He is. So that's awesome. We appreciate that. Sarah Vorster and her daughter Zoe Rose from South Africa.
Zoe.
Yeah, that's what I said. Zoe from South Africa. Thank you. Jared Koch, Stuart Caden, Julia Frifkova.
Why do we let you do this?
From Spirova, Russia, because I murder every pronunciation and you love it. Andrew Berardi, David Lorenzett, and Rachel Rook. Oh, wait, Joe Galindo, too. So, yeah. Oh, Keith Dale. Yeah, so those are all people.
And I'm sure a dozen other people.
Yeah. If you missed your name, let us know how much we suck, and we'll get you on
next
week.
Most of these people are members of our Facebook group.
Yes.
What that is, if you're not a member of it yet, go to facebook.com/group/surrealtalkgroup. And it's just a community of us like-minded individuals where you can go in there and post links to articles about anything from Bigfoot to aliens to Charles Manson to anything you want that's basically how to subscribe our topic set. Fucked up on the side. I don't know.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
join the conversation. Get in there. Eric and I are on there every day, all day long.
So, yeah, if you got something you want to run by us or
something. It's getting a little crazy, though. We're going to have to step back eventually because the amount of traffic we're getting on there right now, it's almost full time.
Yeah, it is. There's only something like 300 members, and it's just. It's every 10 minutes somebody's posting something, and it's like, man, I got to comment on that because that is cool. But a lot of the people there are like-minded, so, I mean.
It's going to get to the point, though, where we're probably going to miss a few replies here and there. And we're
right,
sorry
yeah,
that,
and if we don't directly address your post or, you know, comment, we apologize for that just due to lack, you know, we don't have enough time for that. So, I mean.
Have we talked about what we're talking about doing next week?
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. We always do. All right, hit us with that outro.
All right, so this has been Surreal Talk, a look inside the world of cults, conspiracies, and the paranormal. This is part of the show we'd like to ask you to give a back a little. I don't really want to ask you that, Everett does. If you've really enjoyed the show,
like
you just have, you've just
not that
listened.
We've ever got a dime, but
not at all. If you really enjoy the show you've just listened to, granted we still have not reached any of the minimum withdrawal levels for any of our affiliate programs. Someday, though. We hope to support. We hope one way to support our show is by various affiliate programs. An affiliate program is more or less a reward system. I like reading it now because it makes it better.
I shouldn't have just typed it and handed it to you.
That is, we get a reward if we can successfully refer you to a product. First of these, like you've heard 1,000 times before, Amazon. Visit this URL, surrealtalkpodcast.com/Amazon, and visit our site at surrealtalkpodcast.com. Click the Amazon banner. It will take you to our special Amazon Associates storefront. Wow. I'm sure Everett set that all up.
You're giving us the real Manson treatment.
Yeah. Helter Skelter.
Now, let me ask you, if somebody is listening to this and wants to give me a lot of money to finish writing my book, like To Kill a Mockingbird.
Sure. How would they get hold of you?
Yeah. How do they get hold of me?
Yeah. How? You tell us.
Yeah. I mean.
You got an email address?
How did you get a hold of him?
Oh, you know, Facebook. We could actually send them to Freditorials.
Yeah. Freditorials.com. That's F-R-E-D-I-T because it's F-R editorials.
Yeah.
F-R-E-D-I-T-O-R-I-A-L-S.com.
Yeah.
You get that spelling right, Everett?
Yes, I got it right. He's got a lot of cool blogs he's written on there, from Dio to Manson stuff, to all kinds of great stuff on there. There was an article about Halloween stuff that you did a couple years back I read. I don't know. It's been a while,
and
honestly,
as always,
since I've been to your website.
Remember to like and subscribe to our Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube accounts. That's Facebook.com/SurrealTalk, Twitter.com/SurrealTalkShow, and YouTube.com/SurrealTalkPodcast. But the place you really want to go is, like we said earlier, is Facebook.com/groups/SurrealTalk group. And if you like the contest, you can contact us. You can reach us by email at info@surrealtalkpodcast.com or by messaging us at any of our social media pages. Remember to leave a review on iTunes, as that helps out more than any other, right?
Yeah, of course, lately most of our iTunes ones have been bad.
Yeah,
so
but
just skip that. Never mind.
No, if you got a bad, we read the bad reviews.
Not on iTunes, man. Those mean a lot to me. That's where I really want the high reviews to go. Bonus on Facebook means nothing. High reviews on iTunes means higher in the search.
Oh, higher in the search. Okay, and that's what we're going for, higher in the search. But this has been Surreal Talk. For Everett, Eric, and our special guest this week, Fred, we thank you for listening, watching, and enjoying the show.
Catch you next time.
All right, we're out.
Please, wake up.
This has been Surreal Talk, a lineupmedia.fm production. Listen online at surrealtalkpodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets.
How come I know so much? What the hell is going on around here? Who are you people?
Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter and get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.
This podcast was a presentation of LightUpMedia.fm.